You're listening to Zentertainment Talk Radio on the web at www.zentertainment.org. My name is Joe Davidson. I'm your host, and I'm so glad that you're here today because today's show is so special. It's sponsored by Zentertainment Talk Radio along with the Omega Institute. You can find out more about their workshops and classes and events at eomega.org. If you're not familiar with this podcast, this is a place to discover what is possible, sometimes even in the midst of really overwhelming adversity. Go to the Hear the Show page at zentertainment.org, and you can just click play by any podcast and hear it any time of day or night. You can also sign up free for the newsletter, and the iTunes subscriptions are also free. Make sure to sign up for that newsletter so I can keep in touch with you. The music you're hearing is a song I wrote called Song for My Piano. It's never been released before. Today's guest is Zev Kadem. He's a documentary filmmaker, and he consulted on and appeared in Steven Spielberg's Oscar-winning epic Schindler's List. As an 11-year-old boy, Zev Kadem was one of the 1,100 whose life was saved by German industrialist Oskar Schindler. Germany invaded Poland in 1939, and at that time, Zev Kadem was only 5 years old. He said, "It was dark, and as a 5-year-old, I was fairly afraid." He later recalls, "Little did I know that this darkness that surrounded me would surround me for 6 years." He learned to keep his emotions to himself when his grandparents both attempted suicide to avoid murder at the hands of the Nazis. Within a year, his family was rounded up and brought to the Krakow ghetto with 30,000 other Jews, and barbed wire surrounded their world. Zev Kadem demonstrates the amazing capacity of the human spirit to triumph over unspeakable adversity. And today, I'm really honored to bring you some excerpts from his recent talk at an event sponsored by the Omega Institute. You can also find out more at oskarschindler.com, and that's oskarschindler.com.
My parents, on the first day of the war, separated something which my mother wanted to do for a long time, but could not because of the conservative attitude towards marriage in Poland. So we came into this period as a single family with two children. We spent quite some time in the village, and then new laws were promulgated, and the orders were that the 3.25 million Jews throughout Poland had to stay in designated areas, which we got to know to be the ghettos, and those ghettos it turned out to be quite surprising. When I heard that we had to return to the ghetto with my mother and sister, I was quite pleased because that's where my grandparents lived. And so we arrived at our grandparents' home in the ghetto, but when the door opened, it wasn't my grandparents. There were three other families already living there. So my grandparents said that the best we could do was to live in an apartment across the landing, and that was we shared with two other families, and we had a bed and a white table there. And to internalize those experiences means going inside, and it's not that easy. We were in the ghetto, and then new laws came about, and the laws of the ghetto were that you had to have a work permit. However, before I tell you about the work permit, one of the conditions was that you could only get into the ghetto by carrying your own personal baggage, which meant that the 80,000 Jews of Krakow ghetto had to leave all the property behind, and that was essentially the fundamental motive to exploit a weaker community for the property and for the wealth. So that stayed behind, and it came under the organization of the Nazi organization to make use of the profit. Laws were established where one had to have work permits in the ghetto, and no one under the age of 13 could have a permit because they were not productive, and anyone who was over 30, 35 that wore glasses or something like that was not considered to be particularly effective. They also wouldn't get a work permit. It turned out that the work permits were a question of a passport to life, ultimately, because if you didn't have it, your chances of survival became very small. Soon after those permits, the ghetto was surrounded by forces, and the first deportation occurred. And of course, anyone walking in the street would be picked up. If they couldn't show that they had a work permit, then they were immediately taken and loaded onto trucks just down the road from where I lived, and I could watch this at Platz Gody. Then, with that situation going on, these deportations continued over a period of several months. Every couple of months, there was part of the 30,000-40,000 community were sent away. You can imagine what the situation was like when parents and children were separated. The children and the aged did not have work permits, so they were torn away from the families, and only the workers were allowed to stay behind. Then the efficiency of the system was such that it required too much work to deport 5,000 or 6,000 people. So the Germans decided to divide the ghetto into two parts, the part which had those with work permits and those without work permits. And at the next deportation, they took those without permits. But in the meantime, the process of taking one's family apart went on heartlessly, to say the least. However, there was no indication that this was yet a murderous system that we discovered later on, because the excuse was that they were being deported to a better place of residence than in the ghetto. Then on March the 13th, 1943, there was an additional deportation, and I was by then 8 years old, and I had been hiding in an empty apartment for the past several months. And life wasn't very exciting in the ghetto. So when you had a deportation, I sort of made my way down to the main entrance of where we were and watched the action, how down the road people were being led away and loaded onto trucks to be taken away. And then for the first time in 1943, a shot was fired, and it so happened that it hit a person not very far from me. And I realized that I was in direct danger. Just then my mother, who was the only member of the family who had a work permit, came rushing back. And of course, I got into trouble for daring to expose myself in a place like this. She took me upstairs and collected my sister and my grandparents and took us to the top of a building where we lived, which was a three-story building with a slanted roof, and under the slanted roof were spaces for neighbors to hang their laundry to dry in wet weather. Well, she took us there, And then she parted some slats and told us to get inside. And we discovered that we were in a pigeon coop with a skylight and boxes for the pigeons to stay. Of course, the pigeons weren't there any longer. They were either eaten, but my uncle couldn't keep them because he would be accused of communicating with the enemy. So we sat there in hiding. Now, the feature about this hiding place was that as you came upstairs to the top landing, there was a small metal door into this pigeon coop, but it had a very large metal lock. So we sort of hid from behind, and we sat there hoping that the large lock would persuade anyone that nobody could be inside. We sat there listening through the skylight what was going on, and the normal procedure of a deportation continued. People were being rounded up from the streets, from the neighborhoods. Our neighbors in our own apartment building also were taken away. We could hear all this. And then there was a pause that took quite a part of the morning. There was a pause, and then trucks came around, and they announced that anybody left in hiding, unless they came out and joined the deportation, would be executed on site. We weren't sure what to do about this. We stayed in place, not realizing that this was a last deportation and that the ghetto would be left empty. We sat there listening, and then we started hearing shooting going on in different parts of the ghetto, gradually advancing in our direction. Two buildings away was a children's hospital. Previously we heard the children being marched away for deportation, but now it appeared that those children that were too sick and too weak to be taken away were being executed, and any staff that stayed with them. Now, subsequently, the shooting quietened down, and then searches started. And in due time, a single German came into our building and started searching at great leisure, very slowly, throughout the apartments, and gradually making his way up the steps. We could hear his clicking footsteps to where we were hidden. And in due course, he came to the top landing, and at that point, I was there with my sister and my grandparents. At that point, my grandfather took out two vials of strychnine poison, and one for grandmother and one for him. And of course, you can imagine, not only being tense, but I didn't want to see my grandparents perish, so I started fussing and to prevent them from doing this. And my grandfather said, "Shh, unless you're quiet, we're all going to be killed." And one had to internalize all the stress and the fear to be quiet so that possibly one could live a little bit longer. Well, fortunately, the German looked at this padlock and decided to go into the drying rooms, and we were afraid that he would discover the back entrance, but he didn't. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here to tell you the story. However, we then discovered that we hadn't taken supplies because we thought it was a temporary hiding place. We had two options: either to come out and be shot, or to starve. Those were the two options. Now, in the meantime, two things happened. One, my mother returned to work, and the other was that prior to that, the Germans started developing a concentration camp only 2 miles away from the ghetto. And of course, not by accident, they selected a Jewish cemetery as the site of the camp, because you could destroy the graves and you could trample on the culture that they were determined to destroy. And in fact, when barrack foundations were being built, they smashed the graves, and on one occasion they discovered that the skeletons had gold teeth fillings. So they organized a couple of prison dentists, and the order was to open all the graves and to extract the gold fillings for ostensibly the German war effort. But of course, this type of wealth went to the commandant and was shared amongst his lackeys. And that was the order of the mechanics of a Holocaust. And that wasn't, of course, enough, because the tombstones were used at the entrance of the camp, face upwards, so that when a work detail set off to work, they would know that they're treading into the dust traditional culture. And of course, if any German came from the outside, he also realized that this was the superior culture of death. My mother arrived, being the one with the work permit, arrived in the camp amongst other workers, and she heard that they were organizing Sauberkommando. Sauberkommando were groups that were going to go back to the ghetto to clear out the things of value out of the apartments that have been vacated, which meant silver, gold, candlesticks, carpets, paintings, and so on. And of course, a horse-drawn wagon went with the Sauberkommando. And if there was somebody that was fearless, it was my mother, because she volunteered to go amongst the Sauberkommando with a view to try and save us. And she returned to the empty ghetto, and it was already in the middle of the night. And having heard the previous footsteps of the German who had come towards us, when we heard another set of footsteps, we thought somebody had given us away. But in due course, when the footsteps stopped at the metal door, we heard the traditional and recognized that it was Mother. She came through the back entrance and she told us that we had to do exactly as we were told. My grandparents and sister, who was 4 years older than me, had orders to start looting the neighbors' homes and to take the things of value downstairs and wait for the horse-drawn wagon to load it onto this wagon. And they became part of the Sauberkommando, and therefore those, if they were lucky, they could sneak into the camp and continue living rather than to be executed. However, I was 8 years old, and I had no doubts as to what my own fate was, not after the children next door. So I was sat quietly there, and my mother said, you think that I would forget about you? You come with me. And she took me downstairs behind a large door where I had hidden previously watching the action. And she said, wait here until I signal to you. And in due course, the horse-drawn wagon came along, the stolen goods were loaded onto it, and the wagon master was one of the prisoners, my mother using every ability of her charm, as well as a wedding ring to persuade him, convinced him to hide me under the loot on this wagon. And that's under the weight of all the stuff. I've watched the paving stones as the wagon rolled towards the concentration camp. Of course, at the entrance of the concentration camp, you had inspections. However, this was loot of the commandant, and therefore there was no inspection. And I actually arrived in the concentration camp. However, we're heading for these huge sheds where all the loot was selected, and the best were taken in for the commandant and his lackeys. And it was under German inspection, so I knew that I was in danger, but I didn't know quite what to do with it. Suddenly, once in the camp, I was unceremoniously yanked out by my ankles, and I found myself in an area of darkness, partially built barracks, mud, barbed wire surrounding the place, watchtowers, machine guns, spotlights circling to see that nobody reached the barbed wire fence. And I wasn't even sure who had saved me, whether I hadn't been given up by the driver so that he would not be in danger for smuggling a child in. Because the law that started in the ghetto, which said that children under 13 were considered not productive and therefore were not entitled to have a work permit, now became a law of the concentration camp, that children under 13 were not allowed to be alive in a concentration camp. And I was basically 8 years old and not particularly big for my age. Well, it turned out that a friend, a doctor, Dr. Gross, had saved me. He was a friend of my mother's, and he took me to a barrack where I was told to sit. There was nothing in this room. And late on at night, mother and Dr. Gross came, and they said, well, in a sense, if you've learned to be silent in the ghetto, while hiding in the ghetto, now you will also have to be invisible, because basically children on site are executed. If they're not 13, then you certainly aren't 13. So when one doesn't have much choice, one accepts things as they are. I was quite puzzled what was going to happen. And the other caveat was that if you hid in the residential area, then the chances of being executed and discovered and executed were much higher, because that's where the searches usually took place. So I had to find a place of work to sort of integrate invisibly, to put on a sort of a Harry Potter invisibility cloak during that period. And next morning, there was a group of young men who came to this barrack. They surrounded me, and they became a sort of a camouflage gang. I would walk in the center so that inspecting Germans would not see me. And we walked across the camp to a brush factory, where, to my delight, I found a place of work. I was placed in the back row. A box was placed on the bench so that I appeared at the same height as other people. Everybody was pretty skinny and starved at that time. So altogether, I sort of integrated into the environment and became invisible. Now, the job wasn't a very difficult one. I had to make brushes. It consisted of a piece of wood and some pig's bristle and a wire, and you sort of push the wire through a hole, put some bristle into it, pulled it tight, repeated this a few hundred times, and it was not a challenge for an 8-year-old person, a boy, in contrast to all the other prisoners. And in fact, I had already then realized that to be productive was really the passport to life. So I decided sort of competitively to produce more brushes than anyone else in the workshop. And then I would pile them in front of me to sort of illustrate, hey, no, I'm productive. And it served me quite well in due course, because the only distraction of a month of this type of work was to look out through the side window of this brush factory. And there you had nice green slopes, and to the right there was a mound surrounded by a moat. It was constructed for the First World War defenses of Krakow. And there, on a regular basis, two or three times a week, truckloads of prisoners were brought there. They would be people from the vicinity of Krakow, mostly Jews who had been sort of, whose resources had run out, who were in hiding and were exposed. They would be ordered to get off the trucks, walk onto the mound, men, women, and children, ordered to strip naked. And this was done on this high place so that every prisoner in the camp should be party to see what happened. They were then ordered to walk down into the moat onto the previously disinfected, lime-covered bodies of previously executed people and shot automatically there. And this was a fairly regular occurrence, like watching television today almost, but it was real. This was the one destruction, and on one occasion I saw a German sneaking up on the workshop, and not everybody sort of concentrated on work all the time. I did not want to draw attention to myself, so I didn't even dare to warn everybody else. The German came in. There was an old man, relatively old, he must have been about 30, 35, that was considered old. He had been dreaming, not focusing very well on his work. The German ordered the foreman to send him outside and executed him on the doorstep. Now you'd imagine that was punishment for his non-productivity, but in actual fact, by then, the prisoners were so entirely dehumanized that they weren't entitled to refer to themselves by name, because the name would describe the Jewish culture and that would antagonize and they would get killed. You could only, when you were spoken to, you could answer, and if there was any reference, it was only the number which you had on your lapel. Hair was cut off, and there was a reduction of a human being to basically sub-animal. And the other thing was that now, when the interaction took place of executing somebody, it was like swatting a fly. There was no emotional interaction or any awareness because of this reduction of a human being to a subhuman. The other thing that contributed to it, which made life very difficult, was that the basic food rations which you got, which was a piece of bread and a bowl of watery soup. If you found some sugar beet or something in it, you considered yourself lucky because you would extend your lifespan a little bit, but the actual contents was probably about 30% of what was required, a calorific value that was required to maintain life. So there was a systematic process of starvation that first of all removed any excess fat and then muscle, and then you would have inspections in front of the SS, and anyone who didn't have sufficient muscle structure obviously was not fit to be productive in the camp and would be taken up onto the Huyoba Gorka, onto this sacrificial mount, and executed. This was basically the pattern, and you would say, well, that's terrible, it's dramatic, and so on. But this went on for, I was in Puashov camp for close to 2 years, keeping entirely invisible, except for the one occasion that I actually came face to face with the German. This was on the occasion that I related to you, when he executed the man outside. And to my shock, after the execution, he came back. I also forgot to tell you that basically the motive wasn't just to kill him, but to stimulate production out of fear, to stimulate production in the workshop. After that, the German comes back, and to my shock, he notices me, points at me, and I realize that for the first time after several months in the camps, so I said, no, he couldn't possibly, I'm invisible, he can't possibly see me. However, he persisted at this, so one had to resort to any survival strategy you could in terms of sort of adaptive intelligence at the time. And I fortunately knew German from home, so I spoke quite good German, and I didn't identify with the despised culture. So I said, hi, isn't it a nice day? Look, I've produced more brushes than anyone else. And admittedly, I'm small, and therefore I eat less, and therefore I'm the most prolific producer for your war effort. Well, that confused him, because he had the orders to kill children under 13, and yet, contradiction being that I was productive. And that irritated him, and he sort of stood there at some point, sort of turned around and stalked out of the place. And I want to tell you that at that time I felt that I had beaten the whole culture of death, and that life was wonderful. And the thing was that when you become totally aware, even at your subconscious level, which I didn't know at that time, that you're not supposed to be alive, and you are alive, no matter what the difficulty was, you were celebrating life, you were winning the game of life. And this was the central focus that carried me through the whole period. Subsequently, now, all the critical things, this is a part of the senility, all the critical things I don't stress today, and that is the fact that if there was somebody who was fearless and heroic, it was my mother, because she persuaded the wagon master to smuggle me into the concentration camp, because my survival chances were the highest in the camp rather than to remain in the ghetto. And that took a great deal of courage, and to do this to your own son. Now, this went on for quite a few years, and the only thing that happened was that God didn't come to intercede in this situation. What did happen was the Russians beat back the Germans at Stalingrad and started in 1944, this is already 4 years into the Holocaust, pushing them back westwards, across the Ukraine to Poland, and they were not far away from our camp and threatening the camp. Now, in the meantime, the German headquarters in Berlin decided on the final solution, which was the extermination of everybody who was a Jew. And these orders trickled down to our commandant, and the order was to send everybody from that camp to be exterminated. It is at this point that Oskar Schindler, my other fearless hero, came onto the scene. He was an entrepreneur who found that producing in Poland was cheaper because labor was cheaper, established a factory, but he dealt with his prisoners very well. And here is something which to me is fundamental for each one of us. He was a German, he was part of the Nazi party. When he saw the systematic extermination, he decided to try and save not everybody and not his own community, but a weaker minority, and he risked his life by inventing basically a fictitious factory that would produce ammunition, and he needed the technical support of the workers that had produced pots and pans in the Amalia factory, and by this stratagem succeeded in creating the Schindler's List and moving them to safety. But the most fundamental issue, which I think I'm certainly aware of, is that had he been a perfect human being, a righteous, virtuous man, he could never negotiate these corrupt arrangements of where he was paying off to the Germans. So the one thing is, I always say, protect me from perfect people. And strive to help others and to understand others in terms of the sanctity of life and humanity. And Schindler is my amazing hero to have had the courage to do that, not to his own co-religionists, but to an oppressed group of workers as much as he could. We arrived as a result of this. The men arrived in Brilnitz, Czechoslovakia, where Schindler was trying to arrange supplies and medications for his prisoners and to release the women who had been sidetracked to Auschwitz. In that time, we had a sense of relief being in his safe haven. However, a little boy crossed the factory yard, and the local commandant, in Schindler's absence, decided, he was a hardcore Nazi, he decided that he had to demonstrate his loyalty to the old regime. He grabbed the boy, called a general assembly, found four other boys, including myself, and decided to keep his hands clean. He would send the five boys and the fathers to Auschwitz, to the gas chambers of Auschwitz, because he had to send the train to collect the women from Auschwitz that Schindler managed to free as well. So we were sent off to Auschwitz. We arrive on this train at the entrance of the camp, and it says Arbeitsmachtsfrei, but the gates were locked, and I thought, this is wonderful, they don't need us here. But in actual fact, we were unloaded, sent over to the crematoria area, around the camp, and there in an empty concrete building, stripped naked, and ostensibly to get showers, but ultimately we knew what was going to happen. By then we had no illusions that those were the gas chambers. However, we were called aside, and a man grabbed my arm and started punching in a tattooed number in my arm, and that brought tears to my in my eyes. However, they were both tears of discomfort, but more so tears of joy, because under that heartless system, I had no expectations of living through this stage, and if I had a number, this was my reference number inside the camp. We knew we had just beaten the system once again and were taken into the Auschwitz-Birkenau camp in a children's block. Time is running out, so I can't tell you the whole story, but then the Russians also advanced on Auschwitz. The one thing I have to tell you is, which was typical of the concentration camp situation, was that, miraculous, I had been saved so far, and I was in Birkenau. The train that came to pick up the women was standing across some barbed wire from the camp I was in, and I saw a group of women waiting to be taken away. I realized there were the women on Schindler's List that were going to go to the safety of Brinlitz. Amongst them, I recognized my mother and my sister. So you'd imagine, say, hey, mom, or something like this. She thought I was safe in Brinlitz. I pulled up my shirt sleeves and showed her my number, and I tried to communicate to her that she shouldn't worry. Now I was legitimate in a concentration camp, and therefore I was okay. However, you couldn't yell to her because you had a command guard tower with a machine gun watching and just looking for anything that... Well, it took another 40 years before I met my mother after we were separated in... Now, the Russians are advancing on Auschwitz, and usually the standard of things was the most productive were first to survive, to be used up. And there were three transports out of Auschwitz for the Germans to distance themselves from the Russian front. The first transport was about 15,000 people. The second one was for less productive or less... healthy, and the last group were the children and the sick and the weak, and I knew that they were going to be executed. So I sneaked into the second transport, not realizing that this was going to be one of the death marches. We got a loaf of bread and had to march for 7 days on this loaf of bread in a blizzard. And then, thinking that we've already arrived somewhere, we're loaded onto cattle trucks, open cattle trucks, of course, where we became sort of standing sardines. And for another 7 days, we were sent off to somewhere. We had no idea where we were being taken to until we arrived. And we saw Mauthausen, which was an Austrian concentration camp. Only half of even less than that, managed to get off the train because the rest were standing petrified. There wasn't enough room on the truck to collapse when you died. So you had these human statues. Mauthausen, there was a choice between the quarry, which was an impossible place, and the contagious hospital, and I decided that the contagious hospital was more favorable because it would extend my life a little bit longer. And one day in this hospital, by the way, the hospital had 3,000 prisoners there. Every night, by then this was the end of the war, systematic starvation, every night 300 skeletal figures were taken away on platforms to the crematoria. By then, man was reduced from a human being to a subhuman, to a subanimal, to basically a vegetable where brother could not recognize brother because of these insidious systematic starvation. And under those circumstances, you were then taken to the crematoria. This was the system at the time. One day I got up, I spent a month there, again celebrating life, that I was alive, even under those conditions, when I came out and I saw a group of soldiers outside, and I had been conditioned, the soldiers kill. They had different uniforms, but I didn't trust them very much. So what does one do? First of all, one takes off to check whether there's any food. So I go into the general kitchen, nothing there, but in the German kitchen, there was a pot, large pot of potato salad. I had two handfuls. It's still the best food to this day that I've ever eaten. I went outside, and the situation hadn't changed. The gates were open, and this group of soldiers were standing there. And I was convinced they were Germans, but then one of them threw something at me. I grabbed what they threw at me, and it was a bar of chocolate. However, I knew this was a trap. I wouldn't trust them. They just wanted me to get closer so they could kill me. But then I looked more closely, and one of the soldiers was black. And even in the mentality of concentration camp, I realized that no black soldier could be in the Nazi regime. This must be the moment of liberation. Now, by the way, the black soldiers at that time drove American supply convoys, and they were not given arms because they couldn't be trusted entirely. This is, by the way, in terms of attitudes to minorities. Very briefly, you'd imagine that this moment of epiphany, I'm finally free. This was a few days before the age of 11. In actual fact, I had no other interest than to find a place where I could find some food in the fields, because I knew that the surrounding area was antagonistic. It was Austrian, part of the Third Reich. To find some food in the field, to find some warmth, and not to get killed. I had been reduced to a total survival animal. And then the really dangerous period started, because the Germans were just at the point of surrender. The prisoners were in a position of being contagion carriers, and they were also still despised as part of the Nazi culture, and they competed for the food resources of the local community. So the open hunting season was more severe than ever, and I got shot at more frequently during that period than at any other time. But I got picked up by a DP-8 unit that adopted me, and I have a photograph of serving the American Army at the age of 11 in Germany. The United Nations Refugee Organization carried me to England in November 1945, and there I was blessed with a wonderful education at Oxford Primary School. I studied environmental engineering, reached Israel as a soil conservation engineer, had the privilege of rebuilding the Jerusalem. I was 7 years a coordinating engineer in the restoration of the old city of Jerusalem. Found a ruin of a 400-year-old house, which I restored as a home for my family. And my odyssey from Auschwitz finished up at the center of the spiritual world, being productive in the old city of Jerusalem. The rest I'll tell you on another occasion. Time has run out. And thank you very much for your attention. Thank you. happens, and that is that being in this community makes me enormously grateful, because it is a caring community. And from that experience, I don't want to pontificate and tell you what one should do to learn from that experience, but I would suggest a couple of very simple individual things, and that is to develop a habit of conscious kindness on a daily basis to other people and to be open to other individuals.